Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
If you just arrived in this country, a stranger from far away, like really far away, let's say you came here from outer space and you wanted to have some sense of the history of this new world, the scholar Jeremy Dauber says you could probably piece together a decent backstory just by looking at our horror stories. The Puritan experience, the witch trials, the culture wars, nuclear bomb, all of that, he says, was absorbed by the culture and then reemerged as scary books and movies. And slavery, too. In his new book, he tells about one of these horror stories. It's about Henry Box Brown.
Henry Brown, who was known as Box Brown, was an escaped slave, right? He was an enslaved person, and he managed to escape in the period before, of course, the Civil War. And the way that he did that, it was this sort of remarkable thing, right, where he basically mailed himself. He put himself up in a box and mailed himself north. You know, he then went on, after he successfully managed to do this, to kind of tour around the North with his box and with this story, and did so in a way of kind of helping to stir up and to increase the pro-abolitionist sentiment that, you know, was so necessary in terms of getting the support for the kind of the blood and treasure that would have to be expended to fight the Civil War. What was amazing about this was, first of all, the way in which it displayed sort of the cruelty and horror of that institution of slavery in the South. I mean, what kind of horrors, right? What kind of real life American fears must there have been, right? In order to say, well, you know, it would be preferable for me to seal myself up in a box for days at a time, you know, risk suffocation, risk this horrible death of suffocation in order to, you know, escape, to be free. Even when Brown has made it to the North, right, when he's been resurrected, right, there's still this haunting presence. And among many other things, that haunting presence is not just the memory of his trauma, but fugitive slave law. This idea that, you know, if you had escaped to the North, you still could be recaptured and brought back down, you know, into enslavement once again. And so, you know, Brown, as well as many of these other escaped slaves, you know, are walking around with this terrifying sort of possibility haunting them. Brown actually goes to England to kind of get away from this for a while. So in one way, this is a story of a certain kind of American fear. But also, I think, you know, Box Brown is doing this at precisely the time that Edgar Allan Poe is writing his fictional stories of American horror and American fear, the ones that would, you know, go on to influence people for a century, for two centuries almost now. And, you know, Poe specialized, among other things, in stories of being sort of walled up and buried alive and suffocation and all of that, right? So, you know, when you're reading at that point Edgar Allan Poe's stories, you could be thinking about Box Brown. Or when you're hearing Box Brown stories, you could be thinking about Edgar Allan Poe. And the interesting thing I'll say about that is, if you were Edgar Allan Poe, or you were reading Poe's stories that appeared, among other places, in the Southern Literary Messenger, you know, you might not have been on the same side as Box Brown, right? And it's not clear that Poe was either. Right, that you might have been someone who said, you know what I'm really afraid of when it comes to enslaved peoples? I'm afraid they're going to rise up against me. And so it really shows the way that American fear, the story that I tell, right, really is of a historical period, but goes in all sorts of different directions. And the complicated churning muddies of fear and fiction and history and narrative are the ones that I try and sort of tell, you know, in the book.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Jeremy Dauber is with us to talk about his new book called American Scary. He says we write these kinds of stories to unsettle our dreams and rouse our anxieties. In fact, here's the first line of the book. Show me what scares you and I'll show you your soul.
So I think that one of the things that I do is to do cultural history. And one of the things that I am is a cultural historian. And I'm very interested in what makes, particularly American culture, that's what I, you know, work on, right? What makes it tick? And how do you find out what that is? And I, you know, I've worked on comedy and I've worked on horror, and, you know, what makes you laugh or what makes you scream, what makes you afraid, those are really interesting keys into those sort of levers of societal power in a certain kind of way. Because, you know, there's a way in which, you know, we can say whatever we want to say about what motivates us and what doesn't motivate us. We can believe what it is, right? But, you know, what you're actually scared of, what generates those screams, those laughs, is a lot harder to fake. And so, you know, finding these sort of texts of terror, both in real life and in, you know, in fiction, and the things that blur those categories, is a really interesting way to think about sort of American history. And so I tried to tell that story over the course of American history through the, those kind of materials in this book.
So the horror stories that we write and make into entertainment is a reflection of our larger anxieties. But I wondered, what does that do for us? How does that help us? If we're a society, you know, anxious about the nuclear bomb, or we're worried about that, you know, that enslaved people are going to escape and seek retribution, how does that help us to write or produce these horror stories? Like, what does it do for us?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great question. And I think there are a number of different answers. I mean, maybe the most powerful answer for a consuming audience that is not from the writers themselves, but the people who read or watch or listen to this material, right, is that it helps sort of to work through those fears in a kind of more controlled and manageable way. You know, take one of the examples that you gave here, right, of atomic annihilation kind of right after World War II. Right. There was really nothing that if you were maybe for the president of the United States, right, but if you were an average citizen, there was nothing you could do about it. Right. You know, you just walked around with this sort of heavy knowledge that you might look up one day and you see the bombs flying. Right. But you could take that fear and you could go into a movie theater and you could watch kind of an allegory for that in the form of an alien invasion where, you know, the Martians come down and they zap her, you know, and then at the end they get defeated or they go away or something like that. And, you know, you could say, well, okay, I feel a little bit better now for a while. I have some confidence that if something terrible happens, you know, it'll pass or I can vanquish it in this kind of way. And that's not a permanent solution, obviously, but, it, you know, it helps for a little while. And I think that's one of the main reasons why people were so attracted to it. Another might be to work through some of the dimensions of those kinds of fears and sort of almost clarify your thinking about it, but without actually getting bogged down in the particularities of the actual politics or the actual circumstances, so to speak. In the book, I make this argument that the movie, the sort of alien invasion movie from that period, The Day the Earth Stood Still, is really a movie that's about sort of thinking about kind of the bipolar world, sort of this Cold War. But obviously you don't have to say, well, I have to clarify my position exactly on what's happening between Eisenhower or Kennedy and Khrushchev, you know, well, that's a little later. But I can actually just think about it in terms of the philosophical questions posed by Klaatu, you know, which can help in certain ways. But I think that, so there's catharsis and there's also a kind of clarification in some ways.
Well, the catharsis thing is really interesting because you mentioned in the book that if you look way back in human history, you know, back to the Greek philosophers and the playwrights, that horror or Greek tragedy was, as you put it in the book, was understood, I liked this, as a way of taking your fears for a walk.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the questions that I'm getting, you know, when I talk about this book and things like that is, you know, what makes these horrors, these fears, peculiarly American? You know, the answer that I give, which I think, you know, is true, not always satisfying, but also true, right, is that the big aspects of those fears is not peculiarly American, right? People are afraid all over the world and for all time of, you know, huge cosmic things above them and things right next door. But because they take place in a particular inflection and historical context and circumstance that is America, they become American in these particular ways. And that's how, you know, Americans react to them in those particular groundings.
So the guiding light for the book is this question. What has scared the crap out of us? Like, when did that idea come to you as a subject? Like, what got you started and what is it that you wanted to kind of work out? It's very much a popular cultural critique, but it's also very much a literary critique in many ways. So talk about your own interest in it.
I'd always been interested as a fan. Huh. Of horror. Not as much. I mean, I now am a big fan of horror movies. That I was too afraid to watch them as a kid. But I was always a big fan of Stephen King, of horror fiction.
Yeah.
I loved reading that material. And what became clear to me as I got sort of older and I started teaching about things, part of it was this show me your soul aspect of cultural history that I've done in these other contexts. But part of it was also that I became increasingly aware that a lot of the things that generated fear were not precisely falling into the categories of that section that used to be in the video stores when we still had video stores, or the Netflix algorithm, I suppose now, right? Or the Barnes & Noble section of horror, right? It was much broader than that in terms of both stuff that was made up, right? You wouldn't necessarily find Henry James's ghost stories or Edith Wharton's fictions in that category, but, yeah, you know, they were there, right? But also that a lot of the fear wasn't, it was very hard to define as either fiction or nonfiction precisely. You know, you had material that would be out there that was like, let's say, the mass hysteria of the satanic panics, yeah, right, of the 90s. And, you know, that in some sense that was made up, right? It didn't actually happen, but it wasn't fiction in the way that we would normally understand that. And of course, there were all sorts of ways in which fear has been shamefully deployed through American history. Nativist panics, anti-immigration sort of riots and things like that, in slavery, that really sort of traded on fear as an engine that I thought were really important to the story in themselves, as well as generating kind of the fictional reflections on them. So I said, you know, let me just take it, you know, it all has to be taken kind of as a category because there are all these interesting connections between them. And I think it would be a more explanatory and hopefully interesting book to show those connections rather than simply sort of trace the fictional material.
Yeah. Let's sort of define some terms here, or at least the categories that you lay out in the book. Everything in the book you say shuttles between these two categories. Let's explain this part first. There's the first part, which is the fear of something grand, or as you've put it, that this is the fear of the horror beyond. What's this fear?
So one of the biggest fears that human beings have always had is of this grand sort of unknown, the stuff that's beyond our ken. And we've had over the millennia all sorts of ways in which we've kind of placed that fear, and we've concretized it in certain kind of terms. The most famous of them, and I think in many ways still the most powerful in terms of history, are the ones that come under the name of religion in the most broadly defined kind of way.
Yeah.
You know, what controls our destiny? How does life and death work? What happens after we die? You know, those kind of big questions. Looking around at the world, it's not always clear that the answers to those questions are necessarily pleasant ones. Maybe they are, but they don't have to be, certainly. And we have to consider that prospect. And we have, right? And sometimes we've called that the devil, and sometimes we've called it other things, right? But that's certainly been a part of it. But it's not the only part. And, you know, what part of the interesting turn in the story and in the book really occurs around the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, when those kind of more conventionally, confessionally religious explanations no longer have the same motivating power for many people, not everybody, but for many people as they used to. And so different kinds of fears, move in to fill that sort of grand thing. Right now, I think it's fair to say, I live in New York City. New York City has just had a drought warning issued for it today. You know, climate change is something that falls easily into that category for many people.
Well, then there's the other theory you mentioned. This is the monster next door, basically. Yeah. Take us through this one.
So, you know, so that's the first one, this cause of this fear of sort of the great out there, right? That's what we don't feel like we have a handle on at all, right? And we kind of know in advance that we don't get, you know, have a handle on it, right? But conversely, there's all this stuff around us that we feel like we should or do or might have a handle on, the people who live next to us, people who are just like us or who seem to be just like us, right? And then, you know, we have this fear that they are not who we think they are one bit. Right. That, you know, they seem to be lovely, kind of law abiding citizens, but really they're serial killers or psychopaths or witches or what have you. Right. And, you know, shamefully, sort of that ends up targeting a lot of innocent people. And sometimes it does it retail, so to speak. And sometimes it does it wholesale, where it says, you know, a whole group of these people are, you know, generating fear of a certain kind of thing. Right. And that's led to lots of shameful episodes, of course.
which we'll get to some of these, of course, in the book. I guess let's back up then and talk about that first type of fear and how it manifests itself in the new world. And this is where the story begins, as you say, in the dark. The United States was covered in those early days in woods, deep, dark woods, you write. So mention this. It begins in the dark. And I guess this is just the reference to it's dark out there. It's confusing. It's covered in trees. It's hard to see, right? Like this is the initial – I guess this is the initial impulse for fear. Is that right to say?
Well, I think, you know, and this is sort of an example of a kind of universal fear, the fear of the dark, right, that is kind of inflected in a very particular way, right? So first, you know, the story really begins in the first, bit of the book where, it reminds everybody that, of course, there were people who were living in this land before the colonists come from England. They have a kind of much more, I mean, there's a lot to say about this, but they have a much more organic relationship to this sort of environment they're in. Yeah. By definition, you have people who do not have that relationship to this environment. This is a new world for them, right? It's not new.
Let's spend a few moments on that, though, because I think it is interesting, like what the indigenous stories were, the folklore. And one of the things you say about sort of native people, who, as you said, were used to the trees in the dark part of this new world, or wasn't so new for them. You said what persisted most for them was this sense of the land, its balance between bounty and blight, between kindness and horror. What was their fears before we moved to the fears of the people who started to settle this place?
Well, you know, I think there are these continuities that are interesting, right? Because, you know, there are these, you know, fears of things that are in the landscape that could be terrifying, right? There are fears of powerful entities that are more powerful than them that could be capricious, right? So that, you know, and there are fears of, other people, right? I mean, so you have all of these same categories. And, you know, one could imagine that this could be the basis for a conversation, right? But the colonists come in, one of the things that happens is that they begin to kind of, and of course, everything is more complicated and nuanced than one can talk about in a single interview or even in a single book.
Yeah.
Right. But they begin to put their own categories. And for many of the people who come to the New World, they're very religious sort of Christian categories onto these individuals as well as to this environment that they have. And so you hear these accounts of Native Americans, of indigenous people, you know, as somehow, worst case, let's say diabolic, right? They're instruments of the devil, right? Or maybe even like it, right? They are simply instruments. They haven't been enlightened yet by Christianity. They're not part of sort of the greater plan of what sort of the colonists are trying to do, right? So, or they can be instrumentalized in that way. But either, you know, in any of these scenarios, it's not like they're being treated exactly as kind of autonomous agents with a sort of the dignity of human rights, right, in that kind of way. So that becomes an issue. But certainly in Salem, which is, I think, where we're getting to, you know, you have this idea of, you know, you have these religious Puritans who are coming in, or they have this idea really that the world is a very narrow bridge between sort of the possibility of salvation through God's grace or damnation, right? And it's kind of hard to tell which one you're going to be, but it's not unlikely that you are damned, you know, which is not a great mental health attitude, I think, to begin with. And you know, when you have this kind of perspective, you know, you're also when things begin to happen, you're very prepared to see, whatever's happening as signs of this cosmic struggle that's going on. And that becomes, in some ways, a lot of the backdrop for sort of the witches' hysteria of Salem at the end of the 17th century.
Well, before we get to the thoroughly American stories that are created based on that sense of anxiety, one of the things you mention is that these Puritans brought with them from the old world an idea that the place was, as you say, steeped in devilishness. And they were Puritans, as you point out, so not exactly theater goers, but they must have taken with them some of the stories and plays. You mentioned Dr. Faustus, and you even mentioned Macbeth. What were they drawing on to create their own American horror stories?
Yeah, well, and these are not theatergoers, right? And these plays came out, you know, a couple of decades before the Salem trials. But certainly they're supping of this common idea, right? These ideas in these kinds of plays that the devil is here and about walking on earth, right? That's a possibility, and is attempting to deceive and to elude and to do all of these kind of things to sort of ensnare mortals in these traps of damnation, right? And that's on one side. And then on the other side, Macbeth, you know, is in many ways a play about witches, right, of course. And it's about that witches lurk in these kind of more mysterious spaces on the map, which, you know, to a 1616 or so audience in London, you know, Scotland was a little bit one of those places. Mm. But certainly this sort of place across the Atlantic Ocean was very much one of those places for them, right? And so you do have this sense of here there be tigers, you know, in that kind of way. You know, it was not surprising then perhaps to put all that kind of thing together and say, you know, when people are beginning to behave in ways that seem strange or aberrant or outside of the norms of the community, let's put the name of devilishness on that. Let's call that witchcraft.
You write about the Puritan leaders' increase in Cotton Mather. They come into the story here and how they struggled with these, you know, big, grand theological questions, and, you know, where they fit in the universe and in this new world. And it wasn't really, I guess, horror then, but talk about how it transforms. I mean, one of the things you mentioned was what you describe as America's first bestseller, New England's Crisis by a man named Benjamin Thompson. How is the story starting to evolve here and working its way toward what we would, you know, recognize as something like horror?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting, you know, about, as you say, sort of what we recognize and we don't recognize as horror is, you know, the way in which from the 1690s to the 1990s to the 2020s, you know, we have material that, so to speak, ripped from the headlines, it becomes a kind of sense of horror, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that it's not just, you know, within sort of the lurid pages of a paperback that has kind of embossed foil and fangs and things like that, you know? And so there's this sense of, you know, we are in the thick of it, right, always, right? New England's crisis. And we have these problems that are going on. Some of them are due to increasing amount of hostilities between the colonists and Native Americans. Some of them are due to increasing colonial sort of tensions that are going to culminate, obviously, for America in the Revolutionary War. Everything that basically is grist for the fear mill, it becomes turned into it, you know, so that's what happens.
Yeah. Jeremy Dauber, he's a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Columbia University. His book is American Scary: A History of Horror from Salem to Stephen King and Beyond. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The scholar Jeremy Dauber is with us today to tell the history of horror fiction in the U.S. Dauber says you can write the history of the country just by tracking our scary stories. The witch trials in Salem, the Red Scare, the nuclear bomb, this kind of stuff finds its way into books and movies, and it can help purge the anxiety. It's like taking your fears for a walk. And this is the big question in the book. What in our past has scared the crap out of us? The book is called American Scary. Talk a little bit about the moment of the Salem witch trials and how this plays into the story. I mean, one of the things you mentioned in the book, you say, look, there are a lot of ways to sort of talk about the trials. You can say it's a story of, you know, these different families who are feuding with each other. You can say it was about trauma. You could say it was about different motivations. But here's how you put it in the book. You say, but for now, let's tell it as a 17th century horror tale, plain and not so simple. So how is it a horror tale?
Well, you know, I think that you can say, as I sort of, you know, once upon a time, there was a family in which all of a sudden strange things started happening to them.
Right.
Right. And not just to them, but within them and coming out, right? And, you know, and that is, you know, we're already in the presence of a story. And it's a story in which there's confusion and there's skepticism. We know really what's going on. There's investigation. So there's a dawning belief that this fearful thing is coming, and not just out there and around, but in your own house, right? And then, like so many horror stories, it grows out of control, right? It starts in place A, and then it sort of expands to kind of envelop B and C and D and E, right? If we watch, if we know anything from all the horror movies we watch, it sort of never stays in the first place, always gets bigger, right? And then, you know, eventually, like a lot of, although not all, by no means all horror stories, it ends up kind of sort of snuffing itself out. But in the process, there's been a lot of damage and a lot of trauma, a lot of, you know, people killed and wounded and lives destroyed in its wake.
It's interesting. You say that the first tragedy of Salem, of course, it's the victims. But the second one is this unwillingness to learn from their suffering. Explain what you mean there.
So, you know, there's a phrase that I like to use sometimes about all sorts of things after an event that everyone's analyzing, like, everybody, back to your priors.
Right. Right.
You know, everybody, whatever happened confirmed exactly what I thought it was going to be.
Exactly.
And, you know, one could take that. But I, unfortunately, you know, at that particular point, so, you know, there are a lot of people who really were responsible for supercharging these trials and, you know, got a lot of people killed, right? And at the end, they sort of say, well, you know, maybe they weren't all witches. Maybe you were kind of right about that. But it wasn't my bad, right? I mean, I didn't learn. It was the devil. The devil made me do it. The devil kind of got into my head and caused these illusions that made me think that, right? And so they were not taking on any kind of personal responsibility. They were still abdicating it.
Well, you've talked about the fact that you've got the witches from Salem, how that plays out. And then you fast forward, as you do in the book. We eventually get to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. We get to actual witches like The Witch, Robert Eggers' film. And gosh, dozens and dozens and dozens of witch stories that play out that, you know, in film, in so-called modern America. What's the difference between those stories and these?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, it's a great illustration of the way that the change in sort of underlying historical conditions leads to, you know, a real change in treatment of these, so to speak, same kinds of ideas, these same kind of form, these same kind of monster form. I mean, by the 1990s, when you have you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and you have the Allison Hannigan's character who plays a witch. You know, I think it is fair to say that the world has changed quite substantially for women, you know, and women's position in society than it had in the 1690s. It's not to say that everything is solved by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, there's a greater sort of ability and emphasis placed both in society and culturally on women's autonomy and agency, sort of the fight back against, let's say, sort of sexism and misogyny that's sort of taking place. And so, you know, these witches become kind of an apotheosis of a kind of rebellious feminist bad girl, so to speak, movement that comes place. But the sympathy, you know, has moved in some sense to their side in a lot of cases.
We talked a little bit before about these slave narratives. As you mentioned, slavery was part of the American story, you know, from the beginning. And it was, of course, a horror story. And you write about that. But then you mentioned the sort of emergence of these sort of gothic novels and gothic storytelling. You write about the work of this African-American writer, Charles Chestnut. Say a little bit more about how this fits in your view.
Yeah, well, I think these are two things that are both independent and dependent on each other, right?
Yeah.
They're both independent phenomena, but they have a lot to say to each other. So one of them, you know, is, right, starting sort of in the sort of the 18th, the 19th century, really, the 19th, you know, we have this sort of big excitement about this Gothic movement, right? It's in Europe, it's very exciting. And, you know, Americans want to create a kind of Gothic fiction that speaks to this. And this is a very interesting question for what is really a kind of new republic, so to speak. You know, how do you, you know, the Gothic, you understand what it's like in England. Oh, here are these castles that have been around for hundreds of years and they're crumbling and there's skeletons. You know, how do you do that in a nation that's, you know, 20 years old, right? And in the book, I talk about various kind of approaches for this, but the one that I will focus on here, that really sort of allows both these, is to say that even though the country is new, already there is a past, and that past can be haunting. And that, of course, is one of the essential aspects of the Gothic. And one of the things that haunts the American past into the present, you know, is this stained heritage of slavery, yeah. Right? And Charles Chestnut, the writer you talk about, who really flourishes right at the turn of the 20th century, you know, is dealing, so he's writing, you know, in a period where slavery is still very much in the lived memory of sort of these older generations that are sort of reading his stories, you know, and it's one generation out for many people, right? And he's talking about a lot of the way in which this is not settled, even after the Civil War has been sort of concluded. So in one of his most famous stories that becomes kind of the basis for the title of one of his collections, The Wife of His Youth, he talks about a certain kind of haunting presence that's almost Gothic, which is that it's about a character who is capable of, to use that the phrase they would have used, passing to be white, right? If you didn't know, you wouldn't know that he was black. And while he was enslaved, he had married a woman who was much darker skinned than he was, who would not have been able to pass. And the story that Chestnut tells, this wife of his youth, makes very clear that the character in question is not legally married, as American jurisprudence would have understood the term, nor does he sort of know exactly what happened to this other woman, sort of this wife of his youth, sort of in the war. So he's a perfectly good guy. He's not a rotter, you know, anything like that. But he's about to get married to, and he's sort of found a new kind of social existence in a kind of, you know, black elite society of people who, again, like him, can largely pass. He's about to get married to one of this group. And the wife of his youth shows up as this kind of gothicized, haunting presence on the doorstep right after the wedding. And he kind of has to decide what he's going to do. Is he going to sort of, she doesn't recognize him. And so is he going to pretend like to, you know, that he doesn't know who she's looking for and sort of, you know, continue on with his life as it was? Or is he going to embrace the wife of his youth, this whole kind of haunting path? Right. And he, I apologize for spoiling a 120-year-old story, but he does embrace, right. So he embraces the wife of his youth. He sort of says, we have to kind of, reckon and count this history as part of our history as well. Of course, you know, in its own small way, this is what my book is trying to do as well, sort of take this whole story as part of that.
What was Edgar Allan Poe interested in the stories that he was writing? And what were the anxieties of his time that he was making fit into those really still terrifying stories?
So, you know, Poe, of course, you know, is a phenomenally influential, right? I mean, this is obvious, right? Anyone who's listening to this, you know this already, yeah. Poe. You know, in one level, his contribution really transcends his time in the sense, as you were sort of suggesting, you know, it really is, as a short story writer, and of course, at the time of his death, he was known primarily not as a short story writer, but as a poet. That was what he was best known as. But now, I think it's fair to say he's best known as a short story writer for kind of taking everything within that story and building it up to a one sort of big nuclear bomb of sensation, right, of effect, right? We don't really so much remember all the things that lead up to got a guy being walled up alive and, you know, the Cask of Amontillado. We don't really remember it. We don't really care why the guy has gone crazy because the heart sort of hear it, right? All we care about is that big bang kind of at the end.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's amazing of what Poe did. And in many ways, he really is the catalyst for that in a lot of ways, sort of the American fiction of fear. But that said, you know, one of the things, even though many of his most successful stories aren't sort of, at least on their surface, grappling with a kind of very down-to-earth America, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't really care where the Cask of Amontillado or the Telltale Heart take place.
Yeah.
That's not really that relevant. But other stories of his, they think a little bit about kind of industrialization and mechanization. Some of them are racial allegories. Some of them, his novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym, sort of takes place about this sort of this era of exploration that America is getting part of in the 1830s. So, you know, you do have a lot of, you know, time-bound moments, but I do think that Poe's, you know, in some ways greatest contributions to American fiction of fear, you know, are these aesthetic ones.
It's interesting you write about that time, that transition between the 19th and the 20th century and these anxieties of the sort of the Victorian era, the Victorian Empire, where you had these colonizers who were encountering different civilizations. And I guess this could get us to H.G. Wells and the War of the Worlds in 1897.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the interesting things is, you know, this is a book about America, right? And yeah. and there are only a couple of moments where I sort of say, usually from England, you know, the emphasis is so, there's such an impact. I hate to use the word impactful. such an impact that, you know, you have to include a little bit. And one of them is Wells, right, who really kind of reshapes and creates so much of the material that would then go on the Time Machine, the War of the Worlds, the Invisible Man, right, the Island of Dr. Moreau. I mean, just amazing how much comes out of that incredibly fertile brain.
Yeah.
But Wells is a Brit, right, and he is writing in some sense, and he's a science-oriented guy. I'm not sure that I would call him a scientist, but certainly a science fiction master, right? And he's writing, A, for a world in which, as we were sort of suggesting, that religious sensibility is kind of moving more into the rearview mirror and being replaced by some non-God-centered view of the universe. In War of the Worlds, it's Martians, or this ultimately powerful, you know, hostile alien force, right? But also, he's writing, as you suggested, in a Victorian moment of empire where England is really going off and sort of creating that empire on which the sun never set. What's interesting is that in an American perspective, yes, America had some imperialist expansionism, 100%, but so much of America's growth is also people coming into America in a way. These are massive waves of immigration to America. And that really, unfortunately and terribly, also generates a lot of fear by people who are already there, right? You know, these and they're, you know, whether it's anti-Asian sentiment and racism on the West Coast, whether it's anti-Semitic or anti-Irish or anti-attitudes on the East Coast, you're getting a tremendous amount of fear of sort of new people kind of coming in.
You also write about one of those sort of larger anxieties of people who were as technology, you know, grows and emerges, there's this kind of concern about, as you say in the book, a world that lies beyond the bounds of our own perception. And you tell about this, I guess it's not a novel or anything like that, was featured in The Atlantic. It's a story called The Diamond Lens by a writer named Fitzjames O'Brien, which, and I didn't realize this, you said, you know, Moby Dick and Herman Melville, it's thought of as a classic, but Fitzjames O'Brien, his story was way bigger at the time. Talk a little bit about this story.
So, you know, I think O'Brien is someone who, I mean, fans of horror fiction kind of know who he is, but, you know, largely speaking, he is not a household name. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
And it's a shame because, you know, he really is a very imaginative writer and his stories still have an effect. And I do like The Diamond Lens a lot. And it is a story essentially about a guy who discovers kind of worlds, you know, using a microscope, basically. He discovers sort of worlds entire kind of in drops of water, basically. And what we have, you know, is this idea, and I like how you've connected this, right, to really a way in which our perception is limited, and what is beyond it is just much more rich and baroque and incredible than we actually might have ever imagined. And different people have different sort of perspectives on this. For O'Brien, that's in that story, that discovery becomes the catalyst for a kind of tale of Poe-like obsession. He falls in love with one of the creatures in this like drop of water and tries to kind of make things work out. Again, spoiler, it doesn't work out very well. But, you know, someone like Lovecraft, for example, only a couple of decades later, you know, says, well, what if, you know, it's such a good thing that we don't have this perception because the things that lie beyond it are at best unimaginably powerful and alien and couldn't care less about us and will swat us like flies, or are actively malevolent. And it's just the fact that we haven't come to their notice that has sort of kept them, you know, from killing us. But we disturb them at our peril. So, you know, that becomes a very major shift in the kind of cosmic horror sweepstakes that go on throughout the 20th and into the 21st century.
When do zombies show up?
So, you know, that's a great question. Zombies really show up sort of in the late 20s for the brand, then in the early 30s in movies. And they start out as part of a kind of, let's call it, kind of imperialist and sort of anthropological imperialist impulse in the Caribbean, for America, sort of in the Caribbean, sort of closer to home than some of the outposts of the British Empire, right? And you have, you know, a number of people who are going to Haiti, particularly, right, to the Caribbean. And they're looking at sort of the folk religions there, and they find them sort of, you know, very interesting. And among these are these sort of stories that you have these sort of practitioners of religion that are, you know, capable of, depending on the story, either hypnotizing people into a kind of death-like state, like doing whatever, or even indeed raising them from the dead. And they're kind of the living dead and the walking dead and what have you. And that becomes a kind of really, you know, as you can imagine, a very interesting conceit for people to kind of think about, to play with, right? Some of these prose things become very popular. And then in 1932, a movie is made about this, and it's called White Zombie, and it stars Bela Lugosi, you know, who had just wowed people as Dracula. And it comes out during the Great Depression, right, in 32. And what it is Lugosi, there's a real, besides there being a kind of colonialist aspect to it, but there's a real capitalist aspect too, right, where Lugosi says, you know, I am going to use these sort of walking dead, right, in order to run my mills forever, right? They don't sleep. All they do is work. You know, it doesn't take a genius to kind of look through the allegory there in this time of class war.
Jeremy Dauber, his book is called American Scary, A History of Horror from Salem to Stephen King and Beyond. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the scholar Jeremy Dauber. We're talking about his book, American Scary. So I want to ask about Cormac McCarthy's work. You mention in particular No Country for Old Men, for example, he writes in 2005. One of the things you say is that it's really about menace and unrelenting will, and that Cormac McCarthy becomes kind of the American spokesman for the haunted West. So I wanted to ask about this part, how we got here, and what is that reflecting about the anxieties of the moment?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I'm so glad you brought up the West. I mean, through McCarthy, but the West. Because, you know, in some ways, that both symbolizes sort of the promise of America, right? And also sort of the fear that lurks imbricated in that promise, right? And we go, go West, go West. You know, here's this ultimate possibility. Here's this sort of incredible, you know, opportunity. It's all yours for the taking. We'll bracket with that, the all yours aspect of that for a moment, right? You know, here's this, and then, you know, so much of the literature of the West, including McGrath, you know, is to say, well, what kind of nightmares sort of lie within that, you know, lie on the way to doing that, or whether that's possible at all, or, you know, whether that's just a lie. And those come in all sorts of ways. One of my favorite historical stories, you know, is a story about the Bender family. You know, this is from the, you know, a century before McCarthy, right? But who operate a kind of hotel, you know, on the way for people who are kind of going to the West. It's one of these special kind of motels or hotels where you check in, but you don't check out, right? You know, and you get bopped on the head and then, you know, you get your corpse gets robbed. And this sense of like, there's no real safety or security. You can't trust anybody. You can't, you know. And, you know, you have all of these kind of stories, these revisionist Westerns, movies like The Searchers or Bad Day at Black Rock, which say, you know, here are these things that seem to be, you know, our heroes are so great, but underneath there's all of this sort of other attitudes, right? McCarthy, in some sense, I think, elevates that to almost, for lack of a better phrase, an existentialist sort of position where basically, you know, there's almost nothing but kind of menace and needing to keep going despite sort of all of these horrors that are all around you. Everyone came to McCarthy in different ways, depending on how old you are or, you know, if you came to McCarthy at all. A lot of people I know who are my age or a little younger came a little late to McCarthy and discovered him through The Road, which was a novel of his that I didn't write about in the book, but that is sort of like a post-apocalyptic novel. It's a father and his son, and they're kind of moving along this road, and everything is sort of falling apart. And what's funny to me about that is it's not necessarily hugely different from the ones that are set in McCarthy's non-apocalypse, which I think he would, I mean, he's passed away, but I think what he would have said is almost is sort of the point, right? And to me, you know, one of the interesting movies that I think people are the most surprised that I include in the book, because it has fear in all these interesting ways, even though it's not thought of as a horror movie, is Easy Rider, which is also about people going out to discover the West. And, you know, in some ways, the fear goes all around. Here you have these kind of hippies who, and first they are claiming, in some sense, all of the virtues of what America is. They're like, we're off to discover the real America. And, you know, in the process, they become such a challenge to some of the people who claim to speak for America themselves that, you know, it doesn't end well for them. And that's a fear by the, let's call them the conservatives, you know, in that 60s period, that are afraid of the challenge that sort of these kind of boomer, liberal sort of hippies pose. And it's a challenge to the, I mean, say, you know, what kind of reception am I going to get to this message, right? Yeah. Everybody's sort of scared after the movie, even though it's not thought of in that way.
What are you expecting? What kind of horror stories do you think will come out of this moment, you know, of hyper-partisanship and all this talk about, you know, civil wars and revolution and now resistance and retribution? Can you, I know you can't necessarily back-engineer these things, but what would you start to expect to see? I don't know what the lag time is, but in 10 years, what sort of horror film or novel is going to reflect the anxieties of this moment?
Well, you know, what's interesting to me is that I love movies. I mean, like we just were talking about with Easy Rider, right? That reflect these things. I mean, that's a little bit on the nose, Easy Rider, but like they reflect these things sort of at an angle rather than sort of directly on. So, you know, Alex Garland just came out with this movie, Civil War, that does, you know, that really sort of, you know, addresses this head on. Mm-hmm. But the thing that the movie that really stays with me from sort of the last couple of years is a movie called We Are All Going to the World's Fair.
Right.
Which is about basically, I'm sort of simplifying, but basically an immersive video game. And that increasingly, and it does it more subtly than I'm going to articulate it, but increasingly kind of takes up space inside the players' heads and leads to some very bad outcomes. And the movie, I think, you can read it in a lot of different ways, but I think what's much more powerful about the movie is not any kind of possible metaphysical or supernatural, you know, aspects to this game, right? But the way in which increasingly we live in these worlds that are not the world around us, right? It's a different kind of perception than we were talking about before, but a world in which, you know, the virtual has sort of overtaken the real. And I think that in some ways, when we tell the story of hyperpartisanship, you know, part of that story is about sort of living in our own bubbles of the virtual worlds in which we've algorithmically and otherwise constructed for ourselves. And I think a lot of, you know, these movies, which again, sort of are not real in some deep way, right, but also sort of draw from the real, are going to be more and more adept at pointing out how complicated and blurry and terrifying that situation can be, and how, in many ways, problematically, it replaces sort of the actual empathy of human connection that could be possible.
Quick final question. You say that people often ask the question of those who are creating this horror, like, why are you interested in this stuff? Like, isn't the world scary enough? Why do you need to be scared more? What's the answer to that?
So my facetious answer to this is, you know, considering how scary the world is, all these horror movies scare me less, you know. But I think that there's some truth to this. I mean, it's like, you know, one of my favorite sort of neologisms is the phrase doom scrolling. You know, you're just going through your social media feed, kind of like, you know, it's like, give me a mummy. You know what I mean? Like, just so, I mean, there's some facetiousness to that answer. But like we were saying earlier in the conversation, there's some aspect to which that stuff can be, in its own ways, cathartic and healing. And compared to the headlines, I think that may be true.
Jeremy Dauber, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
Jeremy Dauber, he's a professor of Yiddish language, literature, and culture at Columbia University. His book is American Scary, A History of Horror from Salem to Stephen King and Beyond. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube at KUER90.1, Instagram at Radio West. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.